Good morning. It's time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. I'm reading to you from our studio located at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. My name is Colleen. I'm glad to have you listening. I'll start with a look at today's weather and headlines from the front page. Today's weather forecast, a high of 33, a low of 15. Expect cloudy skies with snow likely in the afternoon and a south wind of 5 to 14 miles per hour. And there was a little bit of sleet this morning. Road conditions in Fort Dodge were good. And the headlines, Unity Point Sanford merger is scrapped. Combination would have included Trinity Regional Medical Center. Downtown Fort Dodge hopes to take a bite out of crime with Business Watch. Something needs to change. Supervisors delay action on option to withdraw from CSS. Double murder jury selection starts in Story County. We'll start with Unity Point Sanford merger is scrapped. Combination would have included Trinity Regional Medical Center. Unity Point Health will not be merging with South Dakota-based Sanford Health, leaders of both organizations announced Tuesday. The president and chief executive officer of Sanford Health blamed Des Moines-based Unity Point Health, which includes Trinity Regional Medical Center in Fort Dodge, for the failed merger. In a written statement, Kelby Krabenhoff said the Unity Point Health Board failed to embrace the vision. Our conversations regarding a potential merger with Unity Point Health have ended, he said. We were excited at the opportunity our combination would have provided to create a new health system of national prominence. The executive management teams and physicians worked diligently for 18 months to provide a merger recommendation to the boards. Diligently. Oh, why couldn't I say that? We are disappointed that the Unity Point Health Board failed to embrace the vision. Unity Point Health officials did not comment on the reason for the collapse of the merger proposal in a written statement. They reported that after significant consideration, we will not be moving forward with a formal partnership. Kevin Vermeer, president and chief executive officer of Unity Point Health, said, I'm tremendously proud of our organization and we will continue to work tirelessly to evaluate any avenue that improves the delivery of health care. Although talks had been underway for 18 months, the possible merger was only publicly revealed in June. At that time, it was anticipated that the merger would conclude at the end of this year. Krabenhoff would have been the chief executive officer of the merged organization, and Vermeer would have been senior executive and vice president. Sanford Health has 48,600 employees, 44 medical centers, 482 clinics, and 200 senior living facilities. Unity Point Health has 32,000 employees, 32 hospitals, and 280 clinics. Downtown Fort Dodge hopes to take a bite out of crime with Business Watch. Leaders of Main Street Fort Dodge are trying to revitalize an inactive Business Watch organization in a bid to fight crime and improve the quality of life downtown. Business Watch is essentially the commercial district version of Neighborhood Watch. Like the version for residential areas, Business Watch seeks to bring people and law enforcement closer together to reduce the impact of crime. About 35 people gathered at Bloomers on Central, 900 Central Avenue, for a Main Street Matters session dedicated to safety and security. A downtown Business Watch was started about 3 years ago but it is not active, according to Chris Patrick, executive director of Main Street Fort Dodge. Jolynn Johnson, a school and community resource officer for the Fort Dodge Police Department, told the group that increasing the quality of life by reducing the impact of crime is the objective of any business watch or neighborhood watch program. It's community-led. It's not law enforcement-led, she said. More importantly, it establishes the connection between our citizens, our businesses, and our law enforcement, she added. Being part of the business watch doesn't mean people should put themselves in risky situations, Johnson said. The best thing our community can be for our police department is to be our eyes and ears, she said. She said citizens should observe and report things to police, providing as much information as they can. She said they can also take photos with their phones of things that concern them and show those photos to police. In another security matter, Jim Bird, president of Main Street Fort Dodge, reported that the group is working with the police department to find grants to pay for an extensive network of cameras downtown. Next article, something needs to change. Supervisors delay action on an option to withdraw from CSS, which is County Social Services. Providing successful mental health care to people who need it has little to do with the building where the care is delivered. It's about compassion and spending time with that person, according to Randy Hoover, program director for Freedom Point. All we want is for someone to sit down and talk to us and treat us like a real person. Hoover, who also suffers from borderline personality disorder, said during the Webster County Board of Supervisors meeting Tuesday morning, about 25 people attended. Supervisors were considering approving a resolution that would allow them the option of withdrawing from the County Social Services region. The resolution would have given supervisors the opportunity to consider the other alternatives. It does not necessarily mean the county would end its arrangement with CSS. CSS often serves as an access point for secondary needs. Those with primary needs are often referred to outpatient care at Unity Point Health, Berry Hill Center. Those with tertiary needs are sometimes helped by Your Life Iowa. After hearing from multiple people, including a jail administrator, police chief, and area providers, supervisors opted to table the resolution regarding CSS. The board will once again consider the resolution during a special meeting at 10 a.m. on Thursday. Prior to the board's decision, there was much talk surrounding the eventual placement of an access center in Webster County, which Allison Hauser, the West Quadrant Administrator for CSS, said could be in jeopardy if the supervisors approve the resolution. Being in limbo like this, our governing boards will not invest the money in this county to do this access center, Hauser said. This is important for our community. The numbers I care about are suicide rates and the number of people being killed here in this community. I am not a business model. I am taking care of the people model. I understand that these are issues and things we need to work on, but we work hard and we work well. Hauser added, what's going to happen is that Access Center will be put in a different county. It will cost a substantial amount of money for transportation. It will cost a substantial amount of money to transport those individuals, and you will lose an opportunity here to do something good for your community. Hoover, who started Freedom Point with help from Ken Hayes, former Webster County Community Services Director, and Bob Lincoln, CEO of CSS, said although providers and supervisors are doing well in their own respects, they need to do more. Hoover said providers are often heard from, But rarely are the people who are actually suffering and receiving treatment for mental health conditions. As a consumer, we really don't give a rat's behind if there is an access center in Webster County, Hoover said. We really don't. Not that it's a bad thing, but it's a little late. Not the opening of the building, it's just a little too late because when I am having an episode or when clients are having episodes, we don't care if you eventually get us in an access center. Hoover added, "Everybody is doing a good job, but you aren't doing anywhere near enough. You need to do more. We can have the access center, we can have this, we can have that. But you know what a person with a mental health episode really wants? What they really want is for someone to sit beside them and talk to them. We don't need a fancy building, we don't need fancy trained people, we just need somebody that cares." Among the board's concerns with CSS has been its transparency. "We talked about transparency and communication," Hauser said. "I think it goes both ways. I think that has been an epic fail on the board's relationship with CSS." Supervisor Keith Danklaw remained interested in finding out the number of people who are served by CSS in Webster County. Danklaw, acknowledging he is making decisions with taxpayer money, has asked for that specific number in past meetings and has been disappointed by answers he's received. "Are we helping 10 people in the county with that 1.5 million and the rest of it's going to the region, or are we helping 500 people?" Dinklaw asked. "I don't know why I can't get that number. I represent the county. I have to find the best place to spend that 1.5 million. But if it's with you guys, that's great. You do a great job. But if we look at someplace else and find a better place to spend that 1.5 million, where our people in Webster County are getting better services, we are elected to do that. It's our duty to look." Representing CSS, Lincoln said he could get Denkla the number he was looking for. "How long does it take to get it?" Denkla said. "I have been asking for 5 years." Lincoln indicated the number of people from Webster County who are served is a complicated number to figure out. When we serve someone and the most complex folks get moved, some people get moved out of state and no longer belong to Webster," Lincoln said. "So we have people shifting residents all the time. But there's no question a proportional number of people are being served in Webster as they are across the region." Lincoln added, "If you want to get to go at risk for Webster County only, then you have to restrict people from leaving Webster County. You have to say that everything you are going to provide has to be in Webster, and that's the whole notion of pooling." Danklaw said, "I just want to know, is it 50 or 20 or 500 or 20? People are asking me how many people use that service. Last time you were here, I have asked, how many people get serviced in Webster County? 1.5 million for 150 people? Is that what we're doing?" There didn't appear to be a clear answer on the exact number by the end of the meeting. Fonda Police Chief Alex Liu and Humboldt County Supervisor Sandy Loney were among those attending who pleaded for Webster County supervisors to stay in the CSS region. "Webster County is our hub," Liu said. "A notice of intent to withdraw, it has that look to it of, well, Webster County wants to look at its options, but every day it has the appearance of you may be gone." Liu said that on Monday night he had to help homeless people from Fort Dodge find a warm place to be in Fonda. "I need you to be in my region," Liu said. "I am coming here almost weekly now, trying to empower these people, going out every day dealing with mental health. I have never dealt more with Webster County Sheriff's Office. I work with them every day. I am getting homeless people all the time." Liu said there are agreements in place for Webster County to be the home of the new access center. "Webster County is always our hub," Liu said. "Whether you want to be that hub or not, you're our hub. Fonda needs the access center here. Pocahontas County needs it. Humboldt needs it. Wright Emmett County needs it here." Loney said each member of the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors wishes for Webster County to stay in the CSS region. We want to work with Webster County, Loney said. We are close. We have several of the services and providers here, so please don't jeopardize us. According to Hauser, Campbell said, I am not sure where this gloom and doom presentation is coming from, but the fact is the money you are investing is our money. We have been a great partner for all these years. We have invested millions of dollars. We are a region. We understand people are transient. We are going to be a good neighbor. Campbell added, we have great providers here that do provide services, so to say that we are going to another region or do something else and destroy relationships with these guys, it's not going to happen. Supervisor Nikki Conrad seemed to favor looking at other options, while Supervisor Bob Thode indicated he wasn't sure about voting for the resolution. To me, if we are going to do this, I would want us to have something in place, Thode said. And if we don't have something in place, either we fix what we've got or we have something in place before we move on. Thode added, if we don't have a plan in place, then leave it alone. Conrad said she remembered sitting in the audience about a year ago hearing the discussions about CSS. That was before she became a supervisor. I kept thinking, we have got to make it work, Conrad said. There are too many people's lives on the line. She added, I have personally been affected by the ramifications of suicide in the last couple of months. I take this very personally. I think every person in this room has recognized mental health is a huge issue, not just in Webster County, but Humboldt, in Iowa, in the United States. But at the same time, Conrad said, not enough people are getting help they need. We are seeing record numbers of farmers and veterans having suicidal ideation, Conrad said. We are not doing enough, and the change I see since I sat out there a year ago is not much has changed. That's what is frustrating. Conrad added, something needs to change, and if it's signing a piece of paper that we intend to leave and giving us that option, if that means I am coming to each place and spending a day with you, I'll do it because something needs to change. Double murder jury selection restarts in Story County. Jury selection for the trial of Tanner King, the Fort Dodge man facing two first-degree murder charges and one attempted murder charge, started once again in Story County Tuesday after exhaustion of a large jury pool and reports of jury tampering interrupted September's first local attempt. With about 75 potential jurors, a slightly smaller group than the 100 tapped in September, the court has already experienced a much faster selection process comparatively. By the end of Tuesday, Assistant Attorney General Susan Crisco completed her voir dire questioning of the pool for the state, and defense attorney Paul Rhodes finished a substantial part of his. In September, Crisco barely scratched the surface of her questioning. The rest of almost two entire days was spent thoroughly vetting each juror privately in the judges' chambers, taking particular care to ensure that none of the jurors knew any of the names on an extensive list of names involved. The court seeks a pool of 16 jurors to finish the trial, four of whom will be designated as alternates. That list of names alone, 140 in total, took Crisco a few minutes to read off. Fewer than five jurors were acquainted with any names on the list. The number is not the number of witnesses that will be called to the stand, but rather the people contacted by, involved in, or mentioned in facilitating the large investigation. We have many, many witnesses, District Court Judge Kurt Stobie prefaced Tuesday morning, telling jurors that preliminary questioning would be critical to finding an appropriate cross-section of life experiences to weigh the different pieces of evidence and testimony offered. Stobie predicted that the trial would run until next Friday or Monday, November 25th, wrapping up before Thanksgiving. It's very difficult to predict how long this will take. Questioning of the jurors, several of whom have previously served on a jury, centered primarily around questions of motives, proving guilt on a reasonable doubt, weighing the credibility of various types of witnesses, and the definition of mediation. The state revealed that some witnesses will testify on the stand in their jail garb, asking if it might affect their credibility. The defense wondered whether jurors would give more credence to testimony from police officers. Both Crisco and Rounds spent a considerable amount of time using pop culture and news references as analogies to help illustrate their questions. Rounds asked which jurors were familiar with Netflix's Making a Murderer, a documentary series in which a Wisconsin man exonerated of a wrongful murder conviction after serving years in prison was subsequently convicted of another murder after suing the local police department that investigated his first conviction. Do you think officers set out to convict innocent people, or are they convinced that suspects are guilty and just do what it takes, Rounds posed, asking if a lack of deliberately attempting to convict an innocent person or a desire to specifically not do so absolve them of responsibility in a wrongful conviction. Crisco referred to video footage from the 90s in which Rodney King was seen being beaten by Los Angeles Police Department officers to ask jurors to articulate their understanding of reasonable doubt, the standard burden of proof prosecutors must clear with juries. Even on videotape, how could we ever prove anything beyond all doubt when disagreement abounds from people who watch the exact same video, she asked. Motive and premeditation dominated a substantial chunk of the state's questioning as Crisco attempted to parse how comfortable jurors would be with deliberating without a clear motive for the crimes allegedly committed. As Rounds followed up on the topic of motive during his examination, the state made an objection. Is the why motive relative to you? Rounds asked before the jury was to clear the room for the objection. Crisco, whose motion was partially sustained, said that the defense was attempting to make motive a relative factor in the case, which she said was not. Perhaps it can be clarified that motive is not an element, Stobie suggested to Rounds. Motive is not an element of the prosecution's argument, and the state does not have a burden to prove the motive for the charges facing King, Rounds clarified with jurors. The defense also got in one sustained objection during the state's line of questioning regarding the definition of premeditation, a key component of the state's burden of proof to secure convictions for first-degree murder. Crisco asked jurors to define what they thought premeditated meant, with many answering that they believed it meant taking advanced steps of planning, often with a time element, shaping their understanding. Do you have to think about it overnight to premeditate it? Crisco asked one juror. No, it could be 5 minutes, the juror replied. Crisco then went on to try and ask whether impulsively pulling over for McDonald's would constitute premeditation, with a decision to pull over formed mere moments before the act, a line of examination that the defense objected to. Rounds asserted that the line of questioning was attempting to lower the burden to prove premeditation, saying that the state was leveling anything one could think about as a type of premeditation. We have a right to know if someone thinks premeditation means something happens for a long time, Crisco replied. I don't think there's a problem asking if they have a preconceived notion of what premeditation is, Stobie said, sustaining the objection. But you were pushing some information to them that could be misconstrued. I just think that's too far. The trial for King may finally proceed over a year after the 2018 shooting he was arrested for. King was arrested in October 2018 after two brothers were found shot to death north of downtown Fort Dodge. He's accused of killing Marion Rhodes, age 37, and L. Dominique Rhodes, age 34, of Fort Dodge. Their bodies were found in an alley near North 9th Street and 3rd Avenue North and behind King's former apartment building at 910 2nd Avenue North. King is also accused of taking a failed shot at Sclecio Clark, then 28, of Fort Dodge, for which he faces attempted murder. Criminal complaints detail an interaction in which Clark allegedly confronted King about bad drugs the defendant had allegedly sold to his girlfriend. The report goes on to say that during the argument, Marion Rhodes walked away and exchanged words with Clark before L. Dominique Rhodes pulled up in a vehicle and got out. The car Clark was driving at the time was allegedly hit with bullets as Clark fled the scene. Although jury exhaustion was foreshadowed as a possibility before the first attempted jury selection, the court was shocked to hear jurors in September report they were being intimidated by individuals outside the court during the first 2 days. The communications that were made to the two jurors that were revealed to us were shocking, Stobie said, before ruling on the venue change to Story County. It tainted those jurors. You are listening to Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. The messenger can be heard daily at 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Joyce L. Lewinsky, L-O-W-I-N-S-K-I, age 81, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Monday, November 11th at her home with her family by her side. Funeral services will be held on Saturday, November 16th at 11 a.m. in the chapel of Loffesweiler Seavers Funeral Home with Monsignor McCoy officiating. Visitation will be held on Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. at Loffesweiler's funeral home. Survivors include husband Bill, daughter Linda Ann Lewinsky of Deep River, son William John Lewinsky of Middletown, Delaware, daughter Patricia Marie, husband Rod Larson of Fort Dodge, six grandchildren, and her beloved dog Anuja. She was preceded in death by parents John and Leota Sullivan Latour, brothers John Patrick Latour and William Latour. Joyce Lorraine Latour was born on September 26, 1938, in Superior, Wisconsin. She attended St. Francis Xavier School there and later graduated from Superior East High School in 1956. Then attended the University of Wisconsin in Superior. On December 28, 1963, she was united in marriage to William Bill Lewinsky. In 1977, the couple moved to Fort Dodge. Joyce showed and raised Alaskan Malamute dogs for over 40 years. She had well over 30 dogs she loved and cared for throughout her life. Joyce was a member of Holy Trinity Parish Twin Ports Obedience Club, lifetime member of the NOWDA, Fort Dodge Kennel Club, and Alaskan Malamute Club of Wisconsin. She was also an avid bowler and was a member of the 500 and 600 Bowling Club. Joyce enjoyed camping and playing softball. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Clifford R. Rhodes, R-H-O-A-D-E-S, Webster City. Clifford R. Rhodes, age 92, of Webster City, died Monday, November 11th at Van Deese Medical Center in Webster City. Private family services will be held at a later date. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. To view the complete obituary and leave online condolences for the family, please visit www.brucesfuneralhome.com. We have a reminder here from Loffesweiler Seavers Funeral Home. Genevieve L. Law, age 90, funeral is today at 10 a.m. at Washington Lutheran Church in Duncombe. Carol Walker, age 51, funeral Friday at 12 p.m., Loffesweiler Funeral Home. Visitation Friday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., Loffesweiler Funeral Home. Joyce L. Lewinsky, age 82, funeral Saturday at 11 a.m., Loffesweiler Funeral Home. Visitation Saturday, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Loffesweiler Funeral Home. And that looks like all we have for obituaries and reminders today. Now on to page 2. Messenger poll, is anyone in your family currently serving in the U.S. military? And the state in history, today is Wednesday, November 13th, the 317th day of 2019. There are 48 days left in the year. On November 13th, 1956, the Supreme Court struck down laws calling for racial segregation on public buses. On this date in 1789, Benjamin Franklin wrote in a letter to a friend, Jean Baptiste Leroy, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." 10 years ago, scientists said analysis of data from two NASA spacecraft that were intentionally crashed into the moon showed ample water near the lunar south pole. 5 years ago, Clayton Kershaw became the first pitcher to win the National League MVP award since Bob Gibson in 1968. Los Angeles Angels outfielder Mike Trout was a unanimous pick for the AL MVP. 1 year ago, Amazon announced it had chosen a neighborhood in the New York City borough of Queens and Arlington, Virginia, as the two locations for its new East Coast headquarters. Amazon later abandoned its New York plans amid pushback from politicians and activists. Thought for today, I have always imagined that paradise will be a kind of library. And that quote was from George Luis Borges, Argentine author who lived from 1899 to 1986. Getting to know our teachers. We have a little article here. The name of the teacher is Peggy Larson and Kirsty Ron, and they teach at Duncombe Elementary, and they teach first grade in a co-taught classroom. And it says, "Why do you teach? We get to make a difference in the lives of kids. Teaching provides us the opportunity to interact and educate students, develop relationships with them, and help them to find success. We are so lucky to have the chance to work with students every day. Helping students reach their fullest potential, all while loving them, is the reason we teach. What is your favorite part of the school day? Our favorite parts of the day are morning meetings and closing circles because we get to build our classroom family. Students share their favorites, what they like to do after school, their wishes, their dreams, etc. We play team-building games together. We have some serious talks, but lots of laughs together, too. We start and end the day together as a classroom family. We also enjoy small group reading because it gives us the opportunity to watch kids work hard and grow in their ability. What are you working hardest on right now? We are working our hardest right now on bringing out the best in each other. We are lucky to have the opportunity to work together by learning and growing every day. We play off each other's strengths to build foundational skills to help our first graders become strong readers. We know the skills they are learning now will be skills they use for a lifetime. What are you most proud of as a teacher? We are most proud of how our classroom is a safe place for all learners. Students who need academic support are able to receive that in our classroom, as well as students who may need emotional support too. We have worked hard to build a classroom family, and we are proud of our Duncombe family. What makes you happiest as a teacher? We are happiest when we see students with smiles on their faces, make connections to difficult learning, and grow in both their academic and social learning. We also love when we see students building each other up and being kind to one another. Our number one classroom rule is be kind. It makes us happy to see students gaining social skills in different situations. How do you contribute to, how are you involved in our community outside of school? Outside of school, we attend sporting events for our families and students, participate in community activities, and take time to explore what the city has to offer. What are your interests and hobbies outside of school? Outside of school, we both enjoy spending time with family, reading, and exploring new places. What do you wish your students or families knew about you? We want our students to know how much we care for them. We want families to know we will always do everything we can to help their child find success. We want them to know how much we truly love having the opportunity to work with the students every day. The students that we work with are not just students, they are our kids. What does Together We Rise mean to you? It takes a team of people, teachers, students, families, staff, and the community all play a part in shaping the future. To us, Together We Rise means that without you, there is no we. We includes the entire community, parents, and students. In order for us to rise together, there must be we. Okay, page 3. He's back, sort of. Randy Will returns as county engineer while vacancies are filled. Randy Will, the Webster County engineer who retired last spring, will be returning to his old job, at least for a little while. The Webster County supervisors approved the hiring of Will during its meeting Tuesday morning. Will will resume his role as county engineer temporarily, while Jamie Joel will serve as secondary roads assistant county engineer. The move was needed as Ryan Wiedemann, who was the assistant county engineer, submitted his resignation. Wiedemann accepted a position as the Hamilton County engineer. He's furthering his career, Joel said. He's going to be Hamilton County engineer. Congratulations to Ryan. Joel said he appreciates Will's willingness to come back. We have had several openings in my department, Joel said. Randy was gracious enough to come back until I can get some additional staff hired. Will is being paid at an hourly rate of $50. Community calendar, Fort Dodge Civitan Club, 7 a.m. Zakir's guests are welcome. Golden K Kiwanis, 9:30 a.m. Tompkins Celebration Center, Friendship Haven, program Dave Beekman, utilities team leader for Cargill. Caregiver support group, 10 to 11 a.m., Elderbridge Agency on Aging at 308 Central Avenue. Kendall Young Library Preschool Storytime, 10:05 to 10:35 a.m., Kendall Young Library in Webster City. NARVRE at 11 a.m. at Community Pizza. Blandon Memorial Art Museum is open 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 923rd Avenue South. Admission is free. Walmart Retirees Luncheon at 11:30, sports page. Webster County Genealogical Society, noon to 3 p.m., Fort Dodge Public Library, located at 424 Central Avenue, room 134. Noon Lions is having a meeting at noon at the Lions Den. AA L&O Club, noon and 7 p.m. at 12 North 7th Street. PEO Chapter JX at 12:30 p.m., Keeley Gunderson, 1601 North 15th Street. Fort Dodge Duplicate Bridge Club, 1 p.m. open game at Citizen Central. Nickel Bingo, 1 p.m. Multipurpose Senior Center in Emmitsburg. Kendall Young Library Teen Lounge, 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., Kendall Young Library in Webster City. Bets Off Gamblers Anonymous at 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., Community and Family Resources, located at 726 South 17th Street. Phone is 576-7261. Open AA meeting at 7 p.m., St. Mark's Episcopal Church, Fox Hall, located at 1001 South 1st Avenue. VFW Post 1856, 7:30 p.m. meeting at the Post Home. AA meeting at 7 p.m. open meeting, 510 South Jackson in Eagle Grove. And on to the opinion page, there's a messenger editorial. Regulations needed on e-cigarettes. People using them to stop smoking shouldn't be harmed. Use of tobacco in all forms can be hazardous to one's health. That is a fact, not open to dispute. Yet cigarettes, cigars, pipe tobacco, and smokeless tobacco are legal for sale in all 50 states with some restrictions. That is a puzzle to many who wonder why federal laws intended to safeguard Americans' health do not seem to pertain to tobacco. They do, however, any tobacco manufacturer adding dangerous substances to the already hazardous product, say opioids, would feel the full wrath of the federal government. The same policy needs to be adopted towards e-cigarettes and the cartridges they use to carry nicotine to users. For months, researchers have been trying to get to the bottom of a nationwide outbreak of pulmonary illness among users of e-cigarettes. Fluid cartridges not produced by major manufacturers have been a focus. One focus was a black market e-cigarette cartridges containing THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. But this week, the U.S. health officials revealed they have a very strong culprit under investigation. It is a compound called vitamin E acetate, found in liquid used by many of the vapors who got sick. The substance has been used as a thickener in e-cigarette fluids, especially those on the black market. Millions of people take vitamin E, of course. It's not dangerous when consumed in pill form or when used on the skin. Inhaling droplets of it can be harmful, however. Knowing precisely what has sickened more than 2,000 users of e-cigarettes and killed at least 40 of them is imperative, of course, but research to date pointing to an additive not used by the major producer of vaping products, Juul Labs, indicates a better system of regulating the industry is needed. Many adult vapers are people using cigarettes, e-cigarettes, as aids to stop smoking tobacco. They are attempting to do something good for themselves. Being hospitalized or killed by adulterated products is a side effect against which they deserve protection. Okay, now on to the back page of the first front half. Fire destroys hog confinement building. 3,000 pigs lost in blaze near Camrar. An early morning fire on Tuesday near Camrar destroyed a hog confinement building and about 300 head of pigs housed in the building. Camrar Fire Chief Tim Mortensen said Camrar Fire Department personnel arrived on the scene at 2980 Lackens Road Avenue about 6:30 a.m. The property is owned by Double G Farms, according to the Hamilton County Assessor's website. It was a total loss, Mortensen said. The building housed feeder pigs and 3,000 head were lost. Mortensen said firefighters from Stanhope and Juul responded to a call for mutual aid. They were a very big help, Mortensen said. We are grateful for the mutual aid. The chief said the cause of the blaze was undetermined. Shortly before noon, the firefighters were called back to the scene to knock down a few hot spots. That's kind of normal, though. It happens with a lot of fires, he said, adding, it took a little time to squelch the hot spots. And there's a photo here. The description is, thick black smoke rises from the scene of a hog confinement fire at 2980 Lakens Road Avenue near Camrar Tuesday morning. The feeder pig building was deemed a total loss, and about 3,000 hogs were lost in the fire, according to Camrar Fire Chief Tim Mortensen. Okay, on to sports. Dodger players honored in District 2. Fort Dodge seniors Kershaw, Thorson, Lee repeat first-timers. Egli is also on top list. Oh, first-teamers, not timers. Egli is also on top list. One of Class 4A's most competitive football districts announced its honor roll this week as 8 Fort Dodge players, 7 of them seniors, landed on the first or second team. Tyson Kershaw, Al Thorson, and Austin Lee were on District 2's elite list for the second consecutive season. The veteran trio was joined by classmate Levi Egli, who fought his way back from a devastating knee injury to become one of the Dodgers' top defenders on a 6-4 playoff squad. We are really proud of our guys, said Fort Dodge head coach Matt Miller, who became the program's all-time leader for career victories during the final week of the season in his 16th year at the helm. Getting to the postseason in back-to-back years is always an outstanding accomplishment. We had a lot of deserving players recognized who gave so much to our program and our school these past few years. It takes a special level of commitment to put this kind of time and effort into a sport and perform at the level these kids have. I hope Dodger fans appreciate what they've watched and the expectations our players have established. A returning elite All-State wide receiver, Kershaw had his third consecutive productive varsity grid campaign while becoming Fort Dodge's career leader in receiving yards and touchdowns. The 6'4" University of South Dakota recruit was 8th all-time in 4A for touchdowns, 24, while finishing 10th in both receptions, 149, and yards, 2,145. Tyson's body of work speaks for itself, Miller said. He commanded the respect and attention of all opposing defenses this year, and even though being the focal point made it harder to get him the ball, he's had a really good season. His name is at the top of our record books and among the best ever in 4A. That's pretty elite company. I still think, though, that Tyson's best ball is ahead of him. In addition to returning as a first-team all-district safety, Thorson was struck into the starting quarterback role as the heir apparent to two-time All-State quarterback Drake Miller. Thorson performed admirably, throwing for 1,602 yards and 17 scores while completing 61% of his passes. Thorson, the grandson of Fort Dodge and Iowa Hawkeye legend Sherwin Thorson and the son of former Dodger All-State linebacker Jern Thorson, also rushed for 329 yards and 10 touchdowns. His 27 overall touchdowns tied Mitch Randall of Waukee for the most in 4A during the regular season. We asked Isle to do a lot on both sides of the ball, Miller said, and as a first-year varsity quarterback, I thought he did a terrific job. He became a running threat for us and really used his athleticism to his advantage. In a perfect world, we probably would have played him at quarterback or safety, but we needed him out there on both sides of the ball, and overall, I feel like he really maximized his ability. There was a lot of pressure on him, both given his family lineage and being Drake's replacement. I'm proud of how he handled it. Lee parlayed a strong junior campaign into an even better senior showing. The 195-pound linebacker led Fort Dodge in tackles, sacks, and tackles for loss. Austin was the heart of our defense along with the other linebackers, Miller said. We knew we could count on him to give his all every Friday night. He was a Dodger in every sense of the word. He had ability, knowledge, and heart. We're going to miss him in our program because he stands for everything we would want in a Fort Dodge football player. Like Lee, Egley flourished in his last go-round. He spent the entire offseason recovering from a serious knee injury suffered in the regular season finale at Marshalltown in 2018. If I could only show you how much Levi put into getting back to full strength during the spring and summer months, Miller said. A lot of time on his own, a lot of time in the dark. That's a testament to his character. It was fun to watch Austin, Levi, Shane Halligan, and Tyler Nichols play together on a defense that forced almost as many turnovers, 31, as any in school history, one shy of the record. They really came through for us time and time again to get us into the playoffs. It started with those four senior linebackers. Now we'll look at Magistrate Court. Theft, fifth degree. Sarah May Washington, age 38. Civil penalty, $65. Law enforcement surcharge of $125. Court costs of $60. Deferred judgment issued. Probation violation, Timothy Allen Chanel, age 34. Transferred to district court. Interference with official acts, Timothy Allen Channel, continued 180 days. Curtis Ross Wilson, age 36, of Marshalltown, trial scheduled for December 6. Public intoxication, Curtis Ross Wilson, age 36, of Marshalltown, trial scheduled for December 6. Speeding, going 62 in a 45-mile-per-hour zone. Adeline Nevin, no age listed. And the fine was $181.50. And to recap the weather, today snow is likely, high around 33, low around 15, wind out of the south at 5 to 14 miles per hour. Thursday and Friday are sunny, high around 31 to 38 and low around 19 to 25. Saturday, mostly cloudy, high around 41, low around 29. Sunday, mostly cloudy, high around 42, low around 29. Monday, partly sunny, high around 44, low around 32. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy, high around 46, low around 32. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. We thank the folks at Friendship Haven for giving Iris a home in Fort Dodge for so many years. And we thank you for listening with Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Have a great day.